This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Wolfsangel, written by M.D. Lachlan, read by Mark Meadows. Chapter 1. White Wolf. Varin gripped the shaft of his spear and scanned the dark horizon, fighting for balance as the waves rocked the little longship. There, he was sure, was the river his lord had described. A broad mouth between two headlands, one like a dragon's back, the other like a stretching dog. It fitted well enough, he thought, if you looked at it with half an eye.
Lord Orthon, King, I think this is it.
The man sitting in his cloak with his back to the prow awoke. His long white hair seemed almost to shine under the bright lantern of the half-moon. He stood slowly, his limbs stiff with inaction and the cold. He turned his attention to the shore.
"Yes," he said. "This is as was revealed."
Varin, a giant of a man a head and a half taller than the king, touched an amulet he wore at his neck at the mention of prophecy.
"We wait until dawn, and then try the river, lord."
Orthon shook his head.
"Now," he said, "Odin is with us."
Varin nodded. Normally he would have regarded it as very unwise to negotiate an unknown river in the dark. With his king at his side, anything felt possible. Orthon was a Volsung, a direct descendant of the gods, and was a vessel for their powers. The tide was slow, but with the boat, and the crew were well rested from the favourable wind that had carried them for a couple of days, and eager to get to the oars. Everything was going well, and no wonder with the king on board. His magic, Varin felt sure, had blessed their journey. The men bent their backs, pulling through the waves, propelling themselves at speed towards the river. The ship was more stable under oar than under sail, and its sudden steadiness seemed to reflect the purpose Varin felt as he heaved the boat through the surf. They were going into a fight, no question, and Varin was ready. 10 warriors crewed the ship. Only 10, including the king. But Varin felt no uncertainty, nor scarcely any nervousness. He was with his lord, King Orthon, victor of innumerable battles, slayer of the giant Geat, Geird the Mighty. If Orthon thought 10 men were enough for their task, then 10 men were enough. It was a trick of the gods that such a man had not produced an heir. The rumour was that Orthon was descended from Odin, the chief of the gods. That battle-fond poet felt threatened by his fierce descendant and had cursed Orthon to sire only female children. He could not risk him producing an even mightier son. Varin shivered when he thought of the consequences if Orthon did not father a boy. He would have to name an heir, with all the trouble and bloodshed that would cause. Only Orthon's name held the factions of his kingdom together. Without it, there would be slaughter, and then their enemies would pounce. He glanced at the king and smiled to himself. He wouldn't put it past him to live forever. Varin looked into the Black Hills and wondered why they had come to that land. It was more than just plunder, it seemed, because their ship had slipped away from a quiet beach a day up the coast from their hall, no kinsmen to bid them farewell, no feasting before they left. Only the war gear, the bright heads of the axes, a shield decorated with a painted wolf's head, another with a raven, spoke of their mission. The images bore a clear message to their enemies. We will make a feast for these creatures. They rushed upon the river's mouth, but slowed as the water became more shallow. They did not stop for soundings. Orthon just made his way to the prow of the ship and leaned out over the water, directing the rudder man. Varin smirked to the man at the oar opposite as the ship slid into the river like a knife into a sheath. The other oarsman, a young man of 17 or so who had never travelled with Orthon before, grinned back. "You were right. He is incredible," his expression said. They were proud of their king. The flood tide took them up the river. The channel became perilous and narrow, split into the land between sharp cliffs and hard boulders, but the king found the course. An hour inland with the dark tight about them, their only light a pale slice of moon high in the sky, the push of the current began to fade and the rowing got harder. In front of them, a sandbank loomed midstream, and Orthon signalled for the boat to beach upon it. The small ship was designed for just such a landing, and grounded with a slight judder. Orthon turned to his men and spoke their names in turn.
Vigi, Eivind, Egil, Hela, Kol, Fot, Grani, Arngeir. We are kinsmen and sworn brothers. There can be no lies between us. None of you shall return from this journey. Only Varin will come back with me to the coast to steer the ship. By the time the sun rises, you will all be feasting with your forefathers in the halls of Odin or Freya.
The men largely received the news of their impending deaths without expression. They were warriors, raised with the certainty of death in battle. A couple smiled, pleased that they would die at their king's side.
I would die with my kinsmen, said Varin.
Your time will come soon enough, said Orthon.
He looked at Varin, the nearest he had to a friend. The giant would be needed to get the boat back into the river and to help him with whatever perils they faced back down the whale road to their home. After that, he would let him die.
I have no responsibility to tell you why you must die, other than it is my will that you should. But know that they will sing tales of your deeds until the world ends. We are here to take a magic child, one who will secure the future of our people forever, and one who will be my heir.
What of the child your wife carries? Said Varin.
There is no child, said Orthon. It is a deception of the mountain witches.
The men drew in breath. Orthon was a good king, fair and generous, a giver of rings. He had never even killed a slave in drunkenness, as kings were wont to do. This was shocking news, though. The men despised liars, and this was very near to a lie. Also, it bore the mark of magic, and women's magic at that. The warriors shifted in their seats. Death did not scare them. They found it as companionable as a dog. But the mountain witches terrified them. Only the king, half a god himself, could speak to the witches, and even he had to be wary. Their advice had proved true in the past, but the sacrifices they demanded were terrible, and always the same. Children. Boys for servants, girls to continue their strange traditions.
The child is a captive in the village here, taken from the sorcerers of the far west, said Orthon. He is a son of the gods, and will lead us to greatness. These farmers do not yet realize what they have. We will part them from it before they do. The village is defended only by farmers, but there are warriors not 2 hours' ride away.
He looked out into the dark. Somewhere in the distance, the sky was taking on a soft pink glow.
Their beacons are lit, he said. We can expect opposition. We will find the child with a priest of their god. The building is marked like this, as their holy places are.
He made a cross with his fingers.
Follow me as we fight to their temple. Then we cut our way back to the boat. By that time the tide will have turned, and I will leave you to your glory. You will be heroes, and your fame will be everlasting. The village is 5 bends of the river away. Prepare.
The men nodded and went quietly to their work. Spears were unstrapped from the rear of the ship. helmets and thick tunics taken from barrels, war axes unpacked and tied to their backs. Varin and Egil had the honour of dressing the king, helping him into his precious mail hauberk, a burnie, as the men called it, and placing the golden wolf helm, symbol of his family, onto his head. The helmet was the best that could be made, open at the face save for shining cheek guards that made it look as if a giant wolf was swallowing Orthon's head from the rear. From a distance, in the splendid helmet, his eyes blackened with soot, the king would appear as a terrifying wolf-headed man. The warriors placed rings on the king's arms, tied a golden belt at his waist, took off his sea cloak, and put on one of golden thread. Varin passed the king his shield with its snarling wolf's head. Then it was time to take out the sword, the only one on the boat, in its white jeweled scabbard. As Varin took it from its storage barrel, it caught the moonlight. It was a sword unlike any other. The Norse blades were short and straight, useful for hacking close up in conjunction with a shield. This sword, though, was long and thin, with a pronounced curve to it. It was stronger than any straight sword, and though lighter, had cut through enemy weapons many times. Orthon had bought it for a fortune from a southern merchant, who said it came from beyond the dawn, by which Orthon had supposed he meant the east. Wherever it came from, Orthon knew it was enchanted, forged, as the merchant said, by magical smiths in the legendary kingdoms of the sands. The merchant had named it Shamsir, and Orthon had kept the name, as it seemed to contain the stir of the desert winds, or at least how he imagined they would sound. His men called it the Moon Sword. The king was ready. In his war gear he looked terrible and splendid, a god. In fact, compared to his kinsmen, Orthon had little taste for ornamentation. The display was for a reason, to inspire awe in his foes. Varin looked at the king. The West men would need their courage, he thought. Before long the others were ready too. Orthon filled their drinking horns himself.
"To the endless feasts in the halls of the slain," said Hela. "To the endless feasts in the halls of the slain," replied the rest of the men, under their breath in case the enemy should be nearby.
They all drank a deep draught, and then another. The horns were refilled and refilled as the boat was prodded by oar from the sandbank and got under way again, rounding the bends towards their prey. As Orthon had noted, they had been seen. The Westmen were no fools and kept watch on the mouths of the rivers. Already, even before the village came into view, they could see the flickering lights of its warning beacons filling the sky. They would have to be quick, to strike before a body of men could be mustered to face them. No matter, they were used to that. The final bend was taken, and Varin had the impression of a village already being sacked. The beacons were blazing all along the beach and up a hill. The fires revealed what Varin considered a very large settlement of 20 houses leading up to a building with a cross on its roof. Well, at least they knew where it was. The West men had been clever. The beach was backed by cut staves on top of a cliff the height of a man. There was only one entrance to the settlement from the river, a gap you would struggle to fit a cart through. It would have been easy to defend had the defenders been proper warriors. Even from the boat in the flickering firelight, Varin could see by the way the men held their spears and shields that they were more used to tilling fields than fighting. There were gaps in their shield wall, and a couple of spears pointed at the moon. They would have been better advised to direct their tips to the invaders, because the moon wasn't going to cut off their heads. The king was the first off the boat, splashing into the knee-deep water and walking up the beach at the pace of a man carrying a basket of mussels rather than a warrior facing his enemy. The troop followed him, three behind, then four in a shield wedge. Two remained on the boat to guard it. 20 yards from the enemy, Orthon stopped, and his men began to rattle their weapons on their shields, to bay and howl like beasts. Those who still had drink finished it and cast the horns aside. 4 horns a man. Enough to be courageous, not enough to be clumsy. Orthon stepped forward, unsheathing the moonsword, the torchlight turning its metal to fire. His helm, too, seemed to burn, the jewels of the wolf's eyes sparkling out a bloodlust. The king lifted his sword high and screamed,
"I am Orthon the Wolf, king of the Sword Order, sacker of the 5 towns, son of Odin, lord of battle! No man has ever faced me and lived. See the plunder I have taken!"
He waved the sword again, its blade bright in the light of the moon and the fire. The torches caught the jewels on the wolf's eyes, turned the rings on the king's arms to burning snakes, made the scabbard of his sword dance like fire itself. His cloak seemed alive with sparks, and even his mouth, the teeth inlaid with tiny red sapphires, seemed to burn. Only the space where his eyes should have been seemed dead. Dead and pitiless. To the Westmen, Orthon seemed a strange, glittering, eyeless alien. And they knew there was only one place you obtained wealth like that, in battles, and plenty of them. The enemy understood only a word or two of what the king said, but were cowed by the force of his delivery. It could have been a spell, and even if it wasn't, the meaning of his message was clear. Prepare to die. Imagination blended with fear, and to some of the Westmen it seemed that the king really did have the head of a wolf, that his wolf banner, held high by Vought, did snarl and snap in the breeze. A couple of boys fell away and ran. 3 men at the rear melted off to go back to their wives and children and get them away. From somewhere, a bowman, his aim made unreliable by fear, landed arrows into the sand 10 paces away from Orthon's feet. The king didn't move. The arrows had dropped quite softly, meaning the bow was at the limit of its range, and even if the archer improved his shooting, Orthon thought himself well covered on that side by his helmet and shield. His impassive posture terrified the Westmen. A spearman in the front rank ran, dropping his shield, and the others, paralyzed by the sight of the sparkling, fearful king, did not move to close the gap. The raiders charged. The farmers were not quick enough to flee, but their instinct to step back and lift their spears under the onslaught was fatal. The king, transformed from the cold old man who had sat in the boat, knocked 2 men down with his shield charge. A third, who had dropped his spear in fright, had his leg taken off at the knee by a flash of the moonsword. Varin and Egil, in the raiders' 2nd rank, struck at 2 more with their spears. The men deflected the blows, but the fight had left them, and they fled. Fear is catching. 2 heartbeats after the king had felled his first opponent, the Westmen ran for it. Only 1 man had been cut down, but panic had set in.
"To the temple, before the warriors arrive!" shouted Orthon.
Varin quickly killed the fallen man with his knife, and then swiped off his head with a couple of blows from his axe. He put the head on his spear and held it up as a warning to any others that might try their luck. The Norsemen drove on up the hill in their wedge formation. As they went, they cut down 2 beacons and flung them onto the roofs of houses. This wasn't wanton destruction. The more confusion and fear they could create, the better. Ideally, the villagers would flee and hamper the progress of any of their lord's men who were rushing to meet the invaders. Orthon knew that success depended on getting to the child before significant resistance could be mustered. Westmen nobles were a different proposition to farmers. They were raised as warriors from their earliest years, and he didn't want to have to cut his way through such men to get what he wanted. Up the hill they rushed. Here and there, farmers armed with clubs and spears would stand taunting them for a few breaths, screaming defiance, but they would always run before the raiders came through them.
"You promised us death, Lord!" shouted Eivind. "These cowards will keep me waiting forever to begin my feasting!"
"You will be drunk with your father and his father before the night is out!" shouted Orthon.
The church, though the Norsemen didn't know it by that name, was a squat wooden building like the rest in the village, though a solid one. Orthon tried the door. It was shut fast. He nodded to the roof. Sigurd and Egil crouched, their hands improvising a stirrup. Young Eivind ran at the side of the building, and the two bigger men thrust him up onto the thatch. In three bounds he was at the smoke vent, his formidable axe free from its strap.
"Kill no children!" shouted the king.
Eivind disappeared from view through the hole at the apex of the roof. 10 heartbeats later, the door was open, and the other raiders were inside. Orthon looked around, his eyes almost blind from the transition between the blazing village and the dark of the church. He could see virtually nothing until Varin came in with a brand. It was a large windowless space with the hearth that had allowed them access in the center and an altar at the back. Behind the altar cowered 2 of the enemy holy men, trying to make magic by gesturing from their foreheads to their chests. One was clutching one of their precious books inlaid with jewels.
"Find the boy," said Orthon. "He will be here. It is foreseen."
Varin made a quick circuit of the room with his torch, but found nothing. The only people in there were the cowering priests, who seemed determined to die like children rather than face their enemies as men.
"He has to be here somewhere," said Orthon. "Burn the place and see who comes out."
He'd hoped to avoid this simply because it would take too long. Varin walked to where the thatch met the wall. As he applied his brand, there was the sound from above of a child crying. Orthon looked up. Hanging from the rafters was a basket secured by a rope tied to a post.
"Get it down," said Orthon.
The rope was untied and the basket was lowered to the floor. Orthon looked inside the basket, expecting to see the destiny of his race. He was unprepared for what was within. There, pressed together, were 2 naked baby boys, each with a wisp of dark hair exactly as in the vision of the witches. But he had only seen one boy. This was something the king had not counted on. The boys were clearly twins, small, dark and wiry, almost identical. Which one was he supposed to take? Would it matter to the prophecy's fulfillment if he was to take both? Still, Orthon was a leader, and knew that any decision is better than none.
"Take them both," he said.
Orthon killed the holy men and took their book. He didn't have time to prize the gems out of it right there, so he tucked it under his shield arm. Then he had his second surprise. Close up, he could see the altar was just a table covered with a sheet. Orthon lifted the cloth. He thought he heard a noise from inside, though he could see nothing without a light.
"Varin," said the king, gesturing for the big man to come forward.
He did, and passed the king the brand. Orthon peered beneath the table. Shrinking away from him was a small woman. The king had seen her race before on raids. She was a Celt, from the furthest reaches of the Westmen's country. She was beautiful, pale and dark. He pulled her to her feet. Even though he wasn't seeking slaves, she would command a reasonable price, he thought, after he had tried the goods himself. But as she stood up, he took a step back. Only the left side of her face was pretty. The right had been burned terribly, and an awful scar ran from her brow to her chin. Orthon, veteran of so many battles, was taken aback by her eye. It was terribly swollen, with a pinprick pupil just visible in the torchlight. The rest, blood red where it should have been white. It seemed to bore straight into him. He dropped her arm. She was valueless. He then registered her alarm as she saw the basket with the children in it. She wailed and dived towards Varin. Orthon in an instant realized she was the children's mother.
Catch her!
Orthon's command had no explanation, as orders in battle do not. The huge Varin dropped his left arm and lifted her off her feet to pin her squirming at his side. It hadn't occurred to Orthon how he would feed two newborns on the 3-week voyage back, and he almost laughed as he saw how nearly his plans had come to failure from such an oversight. The fates had dropped the woman into his lap.
"With us," said Orthon, striding outside. The church was already burning, but he pitched the torch onto the roof for good measure.
Varin shouldered the basket, the children crying, and the tiny woman under his other arm still struggling. The raiders set off down the hill. The West men were finally sorting out their defense and had managed to find some more skillful bowmen. Arrows flew past the Norsemen, one even glancing off Cole's helmet as they retreated down the slope. They quickly moved their shields to their backs as they ran. Making the boat would be the most perilous part, as they had to cross the open beach. Orthon had an answer to that.
"Cole! Eivind!" he said. "Harry, our pursuers, hide here, and when they pass, attack them from the rear. Take the bowmen first."
Both men discarded their spears and took out their axes. Then they were gone, inside a house, to set their ambush. Against the burning church, Orthon picked up a different pattern of movement. A rider. The Lord's bodyguard were arriving, trained fighters. Orthon had heard traders call these men by many names, Gesith, Thanes, and even, like his own retainers, housecarls. Orthon was not a sentimental man, and knew they were every bit as good as his own warriors. There couldn't be many assembled so quickly, but, squinting through the smoke and firelight, he could see at least 3 horses now. When more arrived, they would dismount to attack. The weapon of fear would be useless against them. It would be spear against spear, with the mob at the Thane's back. He had no time to waste.
"The ship! The ship!"
The remaining 6 raiders ran through the village. Orthon left 4 to lie in wait in the shadows of the last houses before the beach, and shouted to the 2 on the ship to come up and defend the gap in the staves. Only he and Varin pressed on, his kinsman carrying the basket, the king now driving the mother. On the hill, Eivind and Cole died bravely. Cole split a bowman's skull with his axe from behind with his first blow, and knocked a thane unconscious through his helmet with his second. His third strike cleft a bowman from shoulder to chest. He never made a 4th. 2 spearmen came at his flank and struck him in the head and belly. He fell to the ground, and a farmer cut off his head with a hand scythe. Eivind broke a bowman's arm with a poor stroke from his battle-axe. He made up for his slack work with his second blow, taking a spearman's jaw clean off, and managing to continue the arc of his axe so it embedded itself in another's arm. 4 thanes were on him then with axes, and though he landed a solid blow on the shoulder of one warrior, it was at too great a cost. The axe jammed momentarily in the man's collarbone, and another Westman had a free swipe at Eivind's arm. Eivind saw his right hand come off at the wrist. He tried to draw his knife with his remaining hand, but the enemy were too quick for him. An axe split his temple, another bit into his neck, a third sank into his thigh. The blows were rapid, tight as a drum roll. Eivind was dead, but he and Cole had done their job, and the West men moved more warily through the remaining houses, until they saw the pair guarding the entrance to the beach. Brimming with their success in taking down 2 of the raiders, the farmers were deaf to the commands of the warriors to hold their position until archers could be brought to bear on the Norsemen. There was a scream from the villagers as they rushed the men at the gap. Stabbing wildly with their spears or slashing with their knives, they were no match for the discipline of Arngeir and Vigi, whose spears hardly seemed to move, yet two opponents were down. Then two more. The Westmen screamed and jabbered and rattled their weapons, but the raiders kept their movements tight, the economy of their thrusts taking a heavy toll. The five thanes cursed, but felt duty-bound to go to the aid of the peasants. Any one of them would have cut down a farmer for as much as a misplaced word, but faced with invaders, it was their duty to defend the men that put food on their lord's table. As they rushed in, the courage of the farmers broke and they ran out. The four raiders who had been hiding burst into this confusion. In the maelstrom of flailing limbs and weapons, one thane was felled by a peasant who mistook him for a raider. Westmen stumbled and slipped and blocked their comrades' blows as the Norsemen's axes bit and spears stabbed. Some of the farmers managed to get away, but the warriors, beset on both sides, stood and died. Orthon swung the basket with the boys in it onto the longship, and Varin heaved their mother after them. The big man ached to join the fight. He had his orders, but still held himself a coward for minding children while his kinsmen fought for their lives. Varin looked at the woman. She had one of the boys out of the basket and was comforting him. As he watched, a feeling of disquiet came over him. It was as if the woods around the village had begun to seethe. Somehow he could sense the forest coming alive, that the foxes, the birds, and above all the wolves had caught the scent of slaughter on the breeze and were hurrying to the feast. From deep in the trees he heard their howling, the dissonant call of welcome for the dead. He turned back towards the village, itching to go to his kinsmen's aid. From somewhere above him, even over the din of battle, he heard a call, a sound, he thought, like the sky cracking. He glanced up to see a pair of ravens circling.
"My lord," he said, "an omen. Odin is with us.
He sends his intelligences.
Our men have carried the day. They will make the ship."
His voice was full of admiration.
What other leader could hack a victory from such unpromising odds?
Orthon looked at him.
"They will enter legend here."
"Leave them?"
"Leave them."
Varin was stunned, but did as he was told, helping the king shove the boat out into the river. The two men leapt aboard. On the river beach, their kinsmen leaned on their axes. Hela bore a deep cut on his cheek, Arngeir a wound on his chest that stained his tunic red, but otherwise they were in good fighting shape.
"He's going," said Grani.
"He has said we must die," said Vigi. "It's foreseen."
"Varin and the king are no poets," said Arngeir.
"They will tell the tale to a poet," said Vigi. "The words will fit our glory."
Down the grassy hill behind the houses, horsemen were pouring. It was nearly an hour since the lord had seen the village beacons, and he and his bodyguard had ridden hard. There were around 20 of them, at least 2 armoured in burnies, 4 carrying swords, the rest spears and axes. The thanes had come, and in numbers.
"They can begin work on our saga very shortly, I think," said Arngeir.
"We will be remembered forever," said Vigi.
A bowshot away from the raiders, the peasants had cut through the staves, and 5 horses jumped down the small cliff onto the beach. The Norsemen's advantage from holding the gap was gone, and now they had enemies on 2 sides. King Orthon hailed his men from the ship.
"You have played your part in the destiny of the world. You die as heroes."
The raiders saluted him with their axes as 3 horsemen dismounted and drew their weapons. 2 stayed in the saddle, charging into the river after the departing boat. One tried to jump on board, but lost his seat and crashed into the water. The other was forced to pull up by Orthon's flashing sword. Caught by the turning tide, the boat rounded a bend, and the beach drifted out of sight. Then the king and Varin heard the sound of the thane's charge.
"There will be many widows in this country tonight," said Orthon.
"And 8 more in our own," said Varin.
The king lowered his head.
Before the end of the journey, he knew there would be 9.
Still, the fate of his entire race was in his hands. When he returned, his wife would fall into a coma, and the false pregnancy the witches had laid upon her would end. When she awoke, she would have a son, the magic child, the weird child who would lead his people to conquer the earth.
Orthon would have a poet sing of the death of his warriors, and then he could go into his next battle ready to die.
He would face his kinsmen in Odin's halls, and they would know he had done the right thing. He had secured the futures of all their descendants.
All he had to do was work out which child he needed to present to his wife.
Orthon turned his attention to the boys in the basket. Their mother was bending over them, fussing. He wanted to look at them again, but couldn't bring himself to pull her away.
There would be time enough to examine them, he thought.
He sat back in the boat and took off his burnie as Varin steered out to sea on the outgoing tide.
Which child?
The witches would know. They had always known so far. The witch queen would cast her magic, and the true heir would be revealed.
How much would that cost him?
He took out the priest's book and began to pick apart the jewels and precious metal with his knife. He had that and 2 ornate candlesticks. Would that be enough? The witch had an insatiable appetite for gold.
Orthon was not just a fighter. A successful king needs to be a politician, too.
His whole experience and upbringing as a man, a king and a warrior, however, made it impossible for him to recognize his blind spot. He considered only how to fight, persuade, cajole, and manage men. He might be skilled and subtle in his schemes, practiced at bending others to his will, but so were the women of the mountain.
Chapter 2. A Mercy. The dead had never meant anything to Orthon before. Their separation from the living seemed to him so slight that mourning or grief had never come to him. Death was just life in another place. The manner of death was a different thing. Varin needed to die, but he should die like a warrior. The secret of Orthon's new heir must be absolute, and while anyone who was party to it lived, there was the risk that the truth might seep out to whisper from the shadows of the feasting halls, hum through the markets, sing with the wind beneath the sails of raiding ships. Orthon, though, would not kill his friend. The king had been raised to believe that a kinslayer is cursed eternally. It wasn't that he thought of killing Varin and then discounted the idea. It didn't even occur to him. Varin's death was a problem that he would solve the only way he knew how, in consultation. The Norsemen placed great faith in the power of talk. The land was in sight, and the ship labored across a current. Progress would have been difficult with a full haul of oars. With only the sail and a partly cooperative wind, the going was very hard. It was Orthon's last chance, though. Varin had to die now, so his body would be taken down the whale road out to the north, or there was a risk it could wash up on friendly shores, raising difficult questions.
Varin.
Lord, I know I cannot return.
The old warrior knew his king well, and, even facing death, sought to lift the burden from his shoulders.
Orthon lowered his head. Varin said, What shall they say of me, Lord?
Your friends loved you, and your enemies feared you. Of all men on the earth, you were raised the least cowardly. Who could hope for more?
Will they sing songs?
They already sing songs of you, Varin. In death, they will unlock a word hoard to your memory.
Varin stood and breathed the air like a man waking on a fine morning. He peered out to sea.
Lord, I see a sea serpent, a beast of venom and fury, that could devour the world snake himself. Allow me the glory of testing my spear upon it.
As death approached, it seemed Varin was already writing himself into a saga. His language became finer, emulating the songs of the skalds. Orthon joined in to honor his friend.
You are right, brave Varin. Fight and win honor. You will need strong armor against such a serpent. On you I bestow this byrnie, this sheltering roof of blows.
Orthon took his mail coat from its barrel and held it up. Varin bowed, humbled by the honor, and allowed the king to dress him. When the byrnie was tight about him, the king took out the golden wolf helm, its ruby eyes part of a trove of plunder taken from the Franks of the south. He placed it on his friend's head and knotted the straps. Then he tied on his rich cloak. Finally, he put Varin's spear in his hand.
"Tell my wife, she was as fine a woman who ever kept a key," said Varin. "Though she was given to me, I loved her. May my sons serve you as I have served you. Dispose of my daughters in marriage, as if they were your own."
By the prow, the woman slept with her boys in her arms.
"You will dine at my right hand in Odin's hall," said Orthon.
"We shall be drunk for all time," said Varin.
Varin turned to the side of the boat and put one foot on the rail.
"Now, serpent," he said,
his voice low with determination. Without a look left or right, he dived from the longship, stabbing into the waves as he leapt. In Orthon's splendid byrnie and helmet, there was no swimming, and in an instant he was gone. The king swallowed and turned away. Varin's death had been necessary. No more to think about it. In the prow, the woman and the babies stirred, though Orthon was surprised to see she hadn't woken. She had hardly closed her eyes during the voyage, but it was as if she felt some comfort and security coming from the land, and had finally given in to sleep. Orthon, in all his wars, had never killed a woman before. They were too valuable as slaves, was the reason he gave himself. But there was something else. He stood above her, watching the two children sharing her sleep at her breast. He had his hand on his knife. Soon he would use it to kill her, he thought. Perhaps when they met the witches. Perhaps just before he returned to his wife. Whenever, it would be by the knife. The moon sword had only ever killed warriors, and he wouldn't stain it with the blood of a woman. And yet he felt it wrong to finish her with the same implement he would use to gut a fish. She was a mother, and to him that deserved some respect. He'd seen his wife go through labor 5 times, and had wondered how many of his men would stand such pain. There seemed something precious and worth preserving in the bond between the mother and her children, a warmth that seemed to spread from her. Orthon the Pitiless felt something stir in his breast that, had he known it, was the first faint flickering intimation of his doom. The woman had a charm given to her by the boy's father, a curious wandering man in an age when lonely wanderers were rare. Few would dare to walk the land alone, at the prey of hostile villages, offended lords, bandits, wild men, trolls, elves, and wolfmen. But the boy's father had dared. The amulet, just a wolf's head scratched on a pebble, would offer her protection, he had said, and left. So far it had offered her none at all, but she clutched it to her in her sleep. When Orthon the wolf, slayer of the giant Geat, pillager of the east, feared lord of the white wastes, touched his knife and looked down at her, he felt pity. It was a new emotion for him, but who is to say it was the stranger's charm? A man has to become tired of slaughter eventually. Only the gods have an endless appetite for that. The ship, under no direction, had turned across the waves and made a sudden violent jar. Orthon kept his balance, but the woman and the babies were shaken and slid against a chest. They awoke in a confusion of screaming, and for an instant the woman stared at Orthon with that penetrating bloody eye. The king, who could face down any enemy, turned quickly to steady the boat. Action, as always, kept reflection at bay. The woman watched him tie the rudder and work the sail, and thought him the second most terrible thing she had ever seen. She recognized him for what he was, a belligerent self-seeker who had taken all the fears he had in him and thrown them at his enemies. A snatcher, a killer, and a hero. The children's father had said he was bored by heroes, but Orthon seemed anything but boring. Terrible, murderous, almost divine. As he'd taken her from the church, the arrows flying, the fires blazing and the villagers screaming, he had seemed a point of unnatural calm, a rock in the eddying currents of violence. It was as if, for him, that situation was normal. If she ever met the god of war, she thought, Orthon is how he would look. The gods, however, had been much closer in her life. Chapter 3 Night Caller. The mother's name was Saitada, and she had been very beautiful, sold as a young child when she was captured from her own people. Then her name had been Baib. As she had grown, she had attracted the sexual attention of her owner, a smith. He was a generous man and liked to share her with his friends. At the age of 13, she had cursed her good looks, taken a hot iron from the forge and applied it to her face. The smith had been furious. He had tried to beat her, but for some reason couldn't bring himself to do it. He wanted to hold her, to kiss her, tell her he would make things all right. But he knew the girl would never come near him any more, except by force. For as long as he'd owned her, he had been convinced there was some bond between them, that despite her tears and her protestations, her eventual sullen withdrawal, that she felt something for him, even that he was special to her. There, on her face, he confronted the damage he had done, and, as a coward, could not bear to look at it in his home. So he'd just taken her to market. Though she had been delirious with pain from her wound, she remembered that place, where she had stood alongside goats and pigs in the shit and the stink, to be prodded and inspected and sold on.
"This one,"
said the farmer's wife, who could have been mistaken for an upright pig in the wrong light.
"This one, I think, is very suitable."
The farmer, whose advancing years had neither increased his discernment nor reduced his lust, had been delighted. If he positioned her right, then he would have a rare beauty to enjoy. Then he had looked into that eye, and the idea had seemed impossible. He felt bad for having had such lewd thoughts, and took pity on the girl.
"Yes," he said, "she will make a fine maid."
They had asked her what she was called, and she, wishing to leave the sullied little girl with the pretty face behind,
had chosen another of her people's names, Saitara. The farmer's wife had picked her for her horrible looks, fearing to lose her husband's affections to a prettier girl. The wound, she knew, would not put a man off, because a man in passion is a beast that no small deformity can deter. It was the bloody eye that seemed to look through you and expose your sins to shame that would keep her husband true. No man, she thought, could have that look upon him and feel his misdeeds would go unpunished. The farmer's wife was a healer, and had dressed and cared for the girl's wounds with presses of comfrey and chamomile. Lacking children of her own, she lavished attention on her, combed and plaited her hair, made her a pretty dress, and even gave her a bed. Saitara was as happy there as she had ever been, though she swore she would never take another man. And she never did, until she was 17. On the day that she was to go back on that vow, a neighbouring farmer had visited to warn that, very unusually, there was a wolf in the area. Three of his sheep had been killed the night before. In such a tight community of small farms, wolves were rare, put off by the number of men. Hence, the local farmers had little experience of dealing with them. So, Saitara, the farmer, and his wife drove their livestock into the pen by the pigsty and waited the night with the dogs and a spear. You have two ways to go with a wolf, unless you are an experienced trapper. One is to light your torches and sing your songs, hoping that the noise will drive him away. The second is to lie in wait to spear him and kill him. Neither will work, but both courses of action will provide the comfort of doing something. If you come in force, he will slip away and try again tomorrow. If you wait, he can wait longer, until you are tired and sleep takes you. To catch a wolf, you need a trick and a trap, things the farmer did not have. The farmer was eager for sleep and wanted to get things over with, so he commanded silence from the women. Still, he could not quite keep quiet himself, so impressed was he with the weight of his spear. Men who have never had to fight love a weapon. They love to hold it in their hands, feel its balance, and speculate on the damage they might do were they called to do it. There is a killer in every cowardly man, waiting for the right set of circumstances when the time has been drained of the possibility of reprisals, and he feels free to act. The farmer was no different, and began, as he sat in the warm night, to feel the importance the spear bestowed upon him, and, despite himself, to talk.
When I was a boy, it was said no one threw a spear better than I.
The farmer's wife rolled her eyes because she had heard this story before many times when he was in drink.
I thought we were being quiet for this wolf, she said.
I'm just saying, said the farmer. Had I been born higher, I would have made a mighty warrior. As a boy, I had quite the feel for weapons. The Earl himself saw me one day and said he wished half his warriors could shoot a bow as well as I. I was quite the...
Suddenly he was quiet. In the trees by the farm, two gigantic eyes seemed to burn, less a wolf than some fiend from hell. He moved smoothly behind the slave girl. She did not flinch, having endured worse than a wolf had to offer her.
"That is no ordinary wolf," said the farmer's wife.
"Sound the alarm," said the farmer. "Fetch aid! Fetch aid!"
"You fetch aid," said his wife. "You're the man."
"If I move, it might see me," hissed the farmer.
"If I move, it might see me," hissed his wife.
"I am needed to till the land. Who will provide for poor Saitara?" said the farmer.
"I will go for aid," said Saitara.
"Too late. The wolf is among you," said a voice close at their ears. The three turned, but couldn't for a moment see anyone.
Suddenly, so bright and white in the starlit night that they wondered how ever they could have missed him, a young man of around 20 was there. He was strikingly handsome, long-legged and lithe. He seemed to draw the moonlight to him, and beneath it his muscles rippled as if under some silvery sea. For a breath, it didn't seem remarkable that he was almost completely naked. All he had to cover his modesty was a huge and bloody wolfskin draped across his back, a rear paw cheekily positioned by his hand over that part the nuns shun. His hair was bright red, and stood up in a shock.
"Christ's wounds!" said the farmer. "You nearly made me jump out of my skin!"
"Well, I did jump out of mine," said the man, sliding away the paw that concealed his shame, and then whipping it back again.
"How dare you appear in front of my wife like that?"
said the farmer, who was a pious man when it suited him.
"The wolf behind you," said the strange man.
"Where?"
said the farmer.
"Oh, Lord, the eyes!"
The farmer turned to run, but he had those grim, burning eyes in front of him in the wood, and the strange and terrible young man behind. He had nowhere to go, and, his brain running out of ideas for what to do with his body, he simply flopped to the floor.
"Not eyes," said the man. "Just torches left by some kind traveller."
The farmer squinted into the darkness. Now it was obvious. They were just brands.
"As I thought," said the farmer.
"Fire," said the pale man. "That is the way to keep the wolf at bay."
He walked to the wood and returned with the two burning torches. Now he had tied the wolfskin's back paws around his midsection.
"I have covered that serpent that tempted Eve," he said.
The man held the torches up and looked at the peasants.
"A farmer, his pretty piggy wife, and who is this rare beauty? No wonder you panic, old man, to see such a face."
"Oh, he wasn't panicking, I was taking advantage of the terrain. That is why I got down."
"It seems this one knows better than you that fire keeps the wolf at bay," said the man, holding up his hand to Sitada's chin and studying the scar on her face.
Sitada did not flinch to hear his words, because the scorn of a man meant nothing to her. He gently turned the undamaged side of her face towards him.
"Such beauty is a terrible thing," said the man, "for no shield can deflect its dart, and even the most nimble of warriors can no more dodge it than you can, old man."
"You are mocking me," said Sitada, "but I am glad of it, if it means you will not lay your hands upon me."
"No, lady," said the man, "you are far more beautiful to me than any woman on earth. You have snatched the spool of destiny from the hands of the fates and woven a skein yourself."
"You speak fine words, sir," said the farmer.
"High praise from such a judge," said the traveller with a bow.
"And now you're mocking me,"
said the farmer, who, like most old men, tended to hear only those parts of the conversation that concerned himself.
"I once threw a spear the length of a lane, and it stuck in the mud properly, too."
"Don't worry, ma'am," said the man to the farmer's wife. "I shall mock you when I've finished with your husband, but oh, shall I ever finish with such an example? No, ma'am, you are quite safe. I shall never finish with him."
"What of that wolf?"
said the farmer, whose head had become a little disordered since the stranger's appearance, though he had drunk little.
"I have slain that night-time caller, that free man of the forests, that furry sir, O farmer. My manure mangler, my seedy serf, my shit smith."
"But he tore my clothes," said the man. "Will you lend me some of yours, so that I might cover the splendour the priests would call our shame?" He went to pull the wolfskin away, but stopped at the last instant.
"If you have killed the wolf, as I see you have,
Then I owe you a cloak, said the old man. Here in the house I have one that has served me many winters.
I prefer the expensive one you're wearing,